Welcome back, deep divers. Today, we're really going deep, huh? Like, seriously deep into the Old Testament.
That's right.
And we're going to be looking at war in ancient Israel.
Yeah, yeah.
And to guide us on this journey, we're using Dr. Trimper Longman's lecture series, God is a Warrior.
Right.
Just a heads up, folks. We're about to uncover some, well, some pretty surprising stuff about how religion shaped their approach to conflict.
It really is fascinating how intertwined warfare and spirituality were for the Israelites.
You know,
they believed that God was just involved in like every part of war.
Every part. So like even deciding when to fight.
Oh, absolutely.
Wow.
From deciding when to fight to like determining the outcome.
Okay. So they just couldn't like, you know, wake up one morning and be like, let's go bash some heads.
Not at all.
They needed God's permission slip.
Longman makes it clear right from the beginning.
Yeah.
For the Israelites, going to war without God's blessing, I mean, it was just unthinkable.
Well, yeah, I mean, that makes sense. They had this whole covenant thing going on with Yahweh, right?
Right.
But how did they get that green light? Did God, like, appear in a dream or something?
Sometimes.
Really?
Yeah. Like with Joshua. Before the Battle of Jericho.
Oh, right, right.
God spoke directly to him.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, told him to remove his sandals because he was standing on holy ground.
Oh, wow.
Right before a massive battle.
Yeah.
That's a pretty big deal.
Yeah, that's a sign. A sign from God.
A pretty powerful one.
Okay, so holy ground, sandals off.
Yeah.
Got it. But what about when God didn't, you know, make a personal appearance? Did they have, like, a backup plan?
They did. They used the Urim and Thummim.
The what? The what?
Urim and Thummim. They
yeah.
were sacred objects used by the priests to inquire of God.
So, like, a direct line to God?
Yeah. You could think of it that way.
For military advice.
Mm-hmm. David, for instance, he consulted them before going up against the Philistines.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So it was a way to, like, get God's opinion on military matters.
Exactly. But, and this is important.
Okay.
God wasn't, like, obligated to answer every time. Oh. It wasn't like divination, you know, where you're trying to like force a God to tell you something.
Yeah, yeah, right.
This was about recognizing God's sovereignty, you know.
His freedom to choose. Yeah, so it was less about trying to manipulate God and more about like understanding that he was in control.
Exactly. And that makes it very different from how their neighbors did things, you know.
Oh, yeah.
They would consult oracles and read omens and, you know, all that stuff.
Try to figure out what the gods were thinking.
Exactly. But the Israelites, they were acknowledging that God had, like, the final say, even on the battlefield.
So it wasn't just, like, you know, seeking a military advantage. It was about making sure their actions aligned with God's will.
Exactly. It was about seeking his approval.
His approval, right. And that was just the first step.
Mm-hmm.
What was next?
Well, next, the Israelites had to make sure they were spiritually prepared before going into battle.
Spiritually prepared. So, like, it wasn't enough to just have a big army and, you know, sharp swords and all that.
Yeah, no.
They had to be spiritually fit as well. That's fascinating.
Longman points out that they had to be as ritually pure for battle as they were for entering the Holy Tabernacle.
The Tabernacle. Wow. So the battlefield was, like, sacred space.
You could see it that way. Yeah.
Huh. Okay. So spiritually prepared, what did that involve? Did they have like a boot camp for the soul?
Well, they had a range of practices. Circumcision, Passover, maintaining personal purity, lots of things, really.
Right. All right.
For example, before the Battle of Jericho, they all underwent a mass circumcision.
Whoa, hold on. A mass circumcision before a battle.
Yeah.
I mean, talk about commitment. Ouch.
It was a symbolic act of purification.
Yeah.
And covenant renewal.
Right. But still, ouch. I mean, they weren't exactly in prime fighting shape after that, were they?
Well, it shows how seriously they took the spiritual dimension of warfare.
Yeah, I guess so.
Even personal behavior was judged by this standard of ritual purity.
Really? Okay, so, like, what kind of personal behavior?
Well, take Uriah the Hittite. He refused to sleep with his wife, Bathsheba.
Uriah. Oh, yeah, yeah.
While the Ark of the Covenant was on the battlefield.
Right. Okay. Yeah, he was a good guy. Didn't want to leave his buddies hanging.
Well, that's part of it.
Yeah.
But he was also, and maybe even more so, concerned about ritual impurity.
Ritual impurity.
Yeah. Well, it's all there in Leviticus.
The
laws about semen and ritual purity.
Oh, okay. I never really made that connection. I always thought it was more about, you know, camaraderie and sharing the hardships of war and all that.
It was rooted in those things, too.
Yeah.
But it went deeper. It was tied to these very specific religious beliefs.
So Uriah wasn't just being a good soldier.
Right.
He was being a good follower of God.
Right.
Okay, so Uriah, Leviticus, got it. Any other examples of this spiritual prep?
Oh, absolutely. Remember Saul?
Hang Saul, yeah, yeah.
He made a big mistake. He offered sacrifices himself.
He did. What's wrong with that?
Well, Samuel was delayed.
Samuel.
The prophet.
Oh, right, right.
And it was Samuel's job to do the sacrificing, not the king's.
Oh, so like a chain of command thing.
Mm-hmm. Priestly authority was essential, even in warfare.
Okay, so it wasn't enough to just have a good battle plan.
Right.
You had to follow, like, God's rules.
His ordained order in every aspect of the conflict.
Wow, okay. So for the Israelites, war was, like, totally about aligning their actions with God's will.
Absolutely. And that brings us to another key point.
Okay.
They believed that God was the true warrior, not human armies.
Wait, well, yeah, but they had armies, right, and weapons and all that.
They did.
So how could they believe that God was the true warrior?
Well, they believed that victory didn't come from the size of their army.
Okay.
Or their weapons.
Right.
It came from God.
So God could, like, grant victory to a small army.
Exactly.
Even if they were, you know, outmatched.
Mm-hmm. He could also defeat a mighty army, even if they had the best weapons.
So it was all about God's power.
Yes.
Are there, like, any stories in the Old Testament that show this?
Oh, tons. Like the story of Gideon.
Gideon, okay.
He led an army of 32,000 against the Midianites.
32,000? That's a lot of people.
It is. But God told him to reduce his army.
Reduce it?
Yep.
What?
To make it clear that it was God, not military might, that determined the outcome.
Oh, okay.
First, God told him to send home anyone who was afraid.
Makes sense.
That left him with 10,000 men.
Still a lot.
Still a lot.
Yeah.
But then God said, that's still too many.
But
he told Gideon to take the men down to the water.
To the water? Why?
To drink and to observe how they drank.
How they drank? What does that have to do with anything?
God told Gideon to keep only the men who lapped up the water with their tongues like dogs.
Dog lappers. Seriously.
Yeah.
Okay. That's a weird way to pick an army.
It was.
Mm-hmm.
But God had his reasons.
Okay. So how many dog lappers were there?
300.
300 out of 32,000.
That's right.
And they won.
They did.
Against the Midianites.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. So God really chose, like, the underdog in that situation.
He did. To show that victory comes from him.
Okay. That makes sense. Is there, like, a parallel to this idea in the story of David and Goliath? You know, everyone knows that one.
Oh, absolutely.
Right.
That story's not just about, you know, a big giant and a little shepherd boy.
Right.
It's about this core belief of the Israelites.
Mm-hmm.
That God, not human strength, determines victory.
Okay, yeah.
This idea totally challenged the prevailing belief in the ancient world. You know,
yeah.
They thought that that powerful gods gave victory to the strongest armies.
Oh, right. Like, the bigger your god, the bigger your army, the bigger your win.
Exactly.
Okay.
But here's David.
Right.
Armed with just a slingshot.
A slingshot.
And he's going up against this massive giant, this guy with all this armor and weapons.
Mm.
And David says,
stress.
The battle is the Lord's.
Wow.
Powerful, right?
Yeah. It wasn't about David's skill. Or his bravery, even.
Mm.
It was about his faith,
mm-hmm.
his trust in God.
It's a powerful reminder that for the Israelites, the battle always belonged to God.
Always. So, like, even when humans were doing the fighting, God was actually in control.
Exactly. It's this incredible interplay of divine sovereignty and human responsibility.
Divine sovereignty,
meaning
yeah.
God's in control.
Yeah.
But human responsibility.
Meaning we still have to, like, do our part.
Right.
Huh. I never thought of it that way. It's like we're called to act, to strive, to fight.
Mm-hmm.
But ultimately, it's God who gives us the win.
Exactly. We see this idea in, like, the wisdom literature, too, you know?
Wisdom literature. You mean, like, Proverbs?
Yeah, Proverbs. And even in the New Testament.
Really? Like, where?
Well, think about Philippians 2:1-13.
Work out your salvation with fear and trembling, for it is God who works in you.
To will and to act in order to fulfill his good purpose.
Wow. Okay. So this idea of God as the true warrior, it's more than just a nice story. It's like a core belief.
It is. It shapes how they understand everything.
Everything. So did this belief, like, affect how they actually fought.
It did. In fact, for the Israelites, even marching into battle was an act of worship.
Marching. Really? So it wasn't just about, you know, strategy and formations and stuff?
It was about that, too. But it was also about expressing their faith.
Even in the middle of a war. That's amazing.
It is. There are examples of this all over the Old Testament.
Okay. Like what?
Well, in 2 Chronicles 20, there's this king, Jehoshaphat.
Jehoshaphat.
Right. And he sends singers and musicians ahead of his army.
Ahead of the army, like a marching band.
Kind of, yeah. But they were praising God.
Oh, okay.
And guess what?
What?
The enemy was defeated before the Israelites even got there.
Seriously? So, like, the music spared them off?
You could say that. It was a demonstration of God's power.
Okay, so music and worship, they were, like, a part of their war strategy.
You could say that. It suggests that for them, victory wasn't just, you know, a military outcome.
It was a spiritual experience.
Exactly.
Are there, like, any other examples of this mixing of worship and war?
There are. You know the Book of Numbers?
Book of Numbers, yeah.
Longman has this this interesting interpretation. He says that the Israelites' journey through the wilderness, it was structured like a military campaign.
What? Really?
Yeah. Think about it. They had a military census.
Oh, right. In Numbers 1.
Right. And the way they arranged their camp.
Yeah.
It mirrored military camps. And when they set out, Moses says, "Rise up, Lord."
Rise up, Lord. It's in Numbers 10.35.
Exactly. It's like a battle cry.
So the whole wilderness wandering was like one big spiritual battle.
You could see it that way.
A march towards the promised land led by God, their warrior king.
Exactly. And just as they celebrated military victories with, you know, songs and hymns, they also celebrated the end of this spiritual campaign with expressions of praise and gratitude.
That's amazing. So after a victory, what happened? Did they, like, have a big party?
Celebration was definitely a big part of it.
Okay.
Victory songs and hymns were common. Like, think about the Song of Moses after the Red Sea crossing.
Oh, right. The Lord is a warrior. The Lord is his name.
Exactly. And that's actually the first time God is explicitly called a warrior in the Bible.
Wow. Okay. So that image of God as a warrior, it goes all the way back to the Exodus.
Mm-hmm. To one of the most important events in Israel's history.
Were there other victory songs they used?
Oh, yeah. The Song of Deborah in Judges 5. That's another one.
Judges 5. Okay.
And then there are a bunch of psalms that were probably used in the context of warfare.
Psalms. But those aren't about specific battles, are they?
No, but they could be used for all sorts of situations.
Like before a battle.
Yeah. Or during. Or after.
Okay. So the Psalms were like their battle playlist.
You could say that.
Okay. Like, give me an example. Which psalm would they have sung before a battle?
Well, Psalm 7, for instance. It's a lament.
A lament.
A prayer asking God for justice and protection.
Oh, okay. So they were like praying and strategizing at the same time.
Exactly. Their faith was just woven into every aspect of their lives, even war.
Yeah. Okay. I get it. So what about during a battle?
During battle.
Yeah.
Which psalm?
Well, something like Psalm 91.
Psalm 91.
It's all about confidence and God's protection.
Right. He who dwells in the shelter of the Most High will rest in the shadow of the Almighty.
Exactly. God as a refuge, a shield.
Right. Right. A protector. That would be a powerful message to hear in the middle of a battle.
It would. It's no wonder that psalm still resonates with people today, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Even when we're not facing, like, literal armies.
Exactly.
Okay, so before, during, what about after a victory?
After. Oh, Psalm 24 is a good one.
Psalm 24.
Longman thinks it might have been used when the priests were bringing the Ark of the Covenant back to the temple.
After a victory.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. I can almost picture it, like a victory parade.
Right.
And the priests are chanting, "Lift up your heads, you gates, that the King of Glory may come in."
Exactly. It's powerful stuff.
Yeah, it is. Are there any other psalms that they would have used for victory celebrations?
Oh, yeah. Psalm 98 is another one.
Psalm 98.
It's all about God as a warrior king.
A warrior king.
Mm-hmm. He establishes justice. It's a common idea in the ancient world, you know.
Right. The king is a warrior.
Right. And in Psalm 98, it's like the whole creation erupts in praise.
For God's victory.
For God's victory. And his power.
And his justice.
Exactly.
It's incredible how these ancient words, they still have so much power, you know.
Well, they do.
They speak to us today.
Mm.
Even though our battles might look different.
They do.
Okay, so we've talked about the Urim and Thummim, spiritual preparation, God as the true warrior, Psalms as battle hymns.
Right.
Is there anything else about how the Israelites fought that we should know?
Well, there is one more thing, but it's a bit tricky.
Tricky.
Yeah. It's this practice called harem.
Harem.
It's in Deuteronomy. And it involves the complete destruction of conquered cities and everyone in them.
Everyone.
Men, women, children.
Yeah.
Animals, everything.
Wow. Okay. That's intense.
It is. And it's definitely hard to understand from a modern perspective.
Yeah. But they believed it was commanded by God, right?
They did.
So, like, what was the thinking behind that?
Well, for the Israelites, the land was central to their covenant with God.
Right, the promised land.
Right. And they believed that the people living in the land were, they were worshiping false gods and doing all sorts of wicked things.
So they saw it as a way to, like, purify the land.
To make it holy, to get rid of the evil influences.
Okay, so it wasn't just about, like, conquering territory.
Yeah.
It was about, like, a spiritual cleansing.
Exactly.
Huh. It's still a tough concept to wrap your head around.
It is. But it's important to remember that we're looking at this from a very different worldview.
Right. Very ancient worldview.
Exactly.
Okay, well, I'm definitely curious to explore this idea of harem a bit more.
We could do that, but maybe next time.
Next time. Sounds good.
It's amazing how, for the Israelites, even their journey, you know, to the promised land was a kind of a spiritual warfare.
Yeah, like a military campaign.
Exactly.
Wow. It really makes you think about the Exodus story in a whole new way.
It does, doesn't it?
They weren't just, you know, running away from slavery. They were on this mission from God.
A divinely ordained campaign, yeah.
Led by God himself. Wow. Mm-hmm. And we talked about how, you know, they had all these rituals for physical battles.
Right.
But they also celebrated their victories in specific ways, right?
Absolutely.
We talked about the Song of Moses and other victory songs. But did those celebrations go beyond singing?
They did.
Like, what else did they do?
Well, one of the most interesting things about ancient Israelite warfare was how victory was seen as a communal thing.
Communal?
Yeah, a shared experience. Like, the whole community celebrated together.
That makes sense, I guess, given their strong sense of collective identity, right?
Exactly. And their covenant with Yahweh. It was a shared triumph, a victory for everyone.
Okay, so how did this communal aspect play out in their celebrations? What did they actually do?
Well, they'd often hold these big processions, you know, bringing back spoils of war, offering sacrifices to God.
Spoils of war, so like loot.
Yeah, you could say that. Treasure, weapons, stuff like that.
Okay. And the sacrifices, those are expressions of gratitude, right?
Exactly. They were acknowledging that that the victory ultimately belonged to God.
Right. It wasn't just about them. It was about God.
Mm-hmm.
So it was like they were inviting God to share in the victory.
I could see it that way.
They were recognizing that he was the one who'd given them the strength and the strategy to win.
Exactly. And it's important to remember that these celebrations weren't just about, you know, partying and having a good time.
Yeah, okay.
They were also about reaffirming their covenant with Yahweh.
Right, their commitment to God.
Right. And dedicating themselves anew to his service.
So victory wasn't just like an ending point. Mm. It was a chance to start fresh, kind of, to recommit to their relationship with God.
Exactly.
Wow. That's really interesting. So we've been talking about this idea of God as a warrior fighting alongside his people.
Right.
But as we move through the Old Testament, does that understanding change at all?
It does. We see a shift.
A shift.
Mm-hmm. It becomes less about God, you know, literally fighting alongside his people.
Yeah.
And more about God fighting on their behalf.
On their behalf, even when they're not, like, actively fighting in a war.
Exactly. The battlefield kind of expands to include the challenges and struggles of everyday life.
So the focus shifts from physical warfare to spiritual warfare.
You could see that.
Okay. Is there anywhere in the Old Testament where we see this shift happening?
Well, we see it reflected in the Psalms.
Well, the Psalms. Oh, right. We talked about how those were like their battle hymns.
Mm-hmm. But many of them can also be read as prayers for help with everyday struggles.
Okay, so those ancient battle hymns have become like timeless expressions of faith.
Exactly. They're relevant for all sorts of struggles we face today.
Yeah, that's true. You know, when you think about it, we still sing those psalms today.
We do.
In churches, at funerals, at weddings. They really have stood the test of time.
They have.
So this shift toward a more spiritual understanding of warfare.
Yeah.
Is there anywhere else in the Old Testament where we see it?
We do. Mm-hmm. It's evident in how the role of the king changes.
The king. Okay, how so?
Well, in early Israel, the king was often seen as a warrior king.
Right. I mean, leading the armies into battle.
Exactly. But as time went on, there's a shift in emphasis.
Oh, okay.
The king becomes more of a divinely appointed leader.
Divinely appointed.
Mm-hmm. He's responsible for upholding justice and righteousness in the land.
So reflecting God's character.
Exactly. God's character as a just and righteous king.
So the king becomes less of a military leader, mm-hmm. and more of a spiritual leader.
Right. He's supposed to lead the people in a way that that honors God.
That's a big shift.
It is. And we see this this shift really clearly in the prophetic literature.
The prophets. Right.
Like Isaiah and Jeremiah.
Yeah.
They challenge the kings, you know, to live up to their calling, to rule with justice and compassion, to trust in God's power.
Instead of just relying on military might. So true leadership, it's not about power or domination. Mm-hmm. It's about serving God,
mm-hmm.
and reflecting his character in the way you lead. That's true even today, isn't it?
It is. It's a timeless principle.
So this idea of God as a warrior who fights for his people,
yeah.
even when they're not, fighting in a physical battle,
mm-hmm.
does that idea continue into the New Testament?
It does.
Really?
It reaches its culmination in the New Testament.
Okay, how so?
Well, in Jesus.
Jesus.
We see the ultimate expression of God's love and power.
Jesus is a warrior.
He is. He's the true warrior king.
But Jesus didn't, like, lead armies or anything.
No. His victory is won in a different way.
A different way.
Mm-hmm. Not through violence or force, but through self-sacrificing love.
Wow. That's a very different kind of warrior.
It is. He conquers not by destroying his enemies,
yeah.
but by laying down his life for them.
By dying on the cross.
Exactly.
Okay, so he's a warrior in the sense that he defeats evil, but he does it through love, not violence.
Exactly. And in doing so, he defeats the ultimate enemy.
The ultimate enemy.
Which is sin and death.
Wow.
And he opens the way for us to experience true victory and freedom.
So it's a whole new way of thinking about what it means to be a warrior.
It is.
It's not about aggression or domination.
No.
It's about love. Sacrifice and ultimately victory,
mm-hmm.
over the forces of darkness, the things that that try to keep us enslaved.
Exactly.
And this victory, it's not something we earn.
No, it's a gift.
A gift
freely given to us through Christ's sacrifice.
So we don't have to be like warriors in the traditional sense to experience this victory.
Not at all. In fact, Longman argues that in the New Testament, the focus shifts from physical warfare to spiritual warfare.
Spiritual warfare.
Mm.
So what's the battlefield?
Our own hearts and minds.
Our hearts and minds. So the battles we're called to fight, they're internal.
Mm-hmm.
We're fighting against our own selfish desires,
right.
our fears, our doubts, our temptations.
Exactly.
But those battles can be just as real as any physical battle, can't they?
They can. They can be even harder.
Yeah, I think that's true. But the good news is,
yeah.
we're not alone in this fight.
That's right.
We have Jesus, our warrior king.
He's already won the victory for us.
Right. And he gives us everything we need to stand firm, to overcome.
He does.
So what kind of equipment are we talking about here?
Well, Paul talks about putting on the armor of God.
The armor of God.
In Ephesians.
Right, Ephesians 6.
The belt of truth, the breastplate of righteousness, the shield of faith, the helmet of salvation, the sword of the Spirit.
Wow, that's a lot of armor.
It is, but it represents the spiritual resources we need, you know.
To fight those spiritual battles.
To resist temptation.
Yeah.
To overcome evil. To live victoriously in a world that's often hostile to our faith.
So it's not enough to just like have faith.
Mm-hmm.
We have to actually do something.
And to actively engage in the battle.
Right. We have to use the tools that God has given us.
Exactly.
And one of the most powerful tools, I guess, is prayer.
Absolutely. Prayer is essential.
Because it's how we connect with God.
Mm-hmm.
How we tap into his power.
Right.
How we how we invite him into our struggles.
It's like having a direct line to the commander in chief, you know?
Yeah.
Asking for guidance, support, right. Reinforcements.
In the heat of battle.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And just as the Israelites, you know, celebrated their victories together.
Yeah.
We're also called to fight this spiritual battle as a community.
A community.
Yeah. We're not meant to go through this alone.
That's so important to have people around you who understand,
mm-hmm.
who can encourage you, pray for you, celebrate with you.
Exactly. We can learn from each other's experiences.
Right.
Share our burdens.
Right.
Pray for each other and celebrate our victories together.
It's like having a whole battalion of fellow soldiers
mm-hmm.
fighting alongside you, cheering you on, helping yeah. you to stay strong when the battle gets tough.
Exactly. And just as the Israelites' understanding of God as a warrior evolved yeah. over time,
yeah.
our own understanding of spiritual warfare will also continue to grow.
As we walk with Christ.
As we walk with Christ and experience his transforming power in our lives.
So it's an ongoing journey.
Yes.
A journey of discovery, and it's a journey that requires courage,
mm-hmm.
perseverance.
And trust.
Trust in the one who's already won the victory for us.
Exactly.
It really is mind-blowing when you think about it, you know.
What's that?
This whole warrior imagery, like it starts with these super literal battles in the Old Testament,
mm-hmm.
and it ends up leading us to like this deep spiritual truth about Jesus as the conquering king.
The ultimate warrior.
The ultimate warrior. It's quite a journey.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes you think, you know, how can we apply this whole idea of spiritual warfare?
To our own lives.
Yeah, to our own lives. Like, what does that even look like?
That's a great question.
Uh-huh.
And Longman actually spends a lot of time talking about that. You know, he emphasizes that even though the battles we face might not involve, you know, physical weapons.
Right.
They're still real.
Oh, yeah.
And they can be really tough.
No, absolutely. We might not be facing, you know, literal armies,
mm-hmm.
but we're constantly bombarded with all this stuff, you know, temptations, doubts, fears, negative thoughts.
Right.
It can feel like a battlefield sometimes.
It absolutely can. Yeah. And just like the Israelites needed God's guidance and strength to face their enemies.
Yeah.
We also need to rely on God's power to overcome the challenges we face in our lives.
Okay, but how do we actually do that? What does that look like? Is it just about praying more?
Well, prayer is definitely a big part of it.
Yeah.
It's how we connect with God, how we tap into his power.
Right.
How we invite him into our struggles.
Oh, okay.
But it's also about being intentional.
Intentional. About what?
About renewing our minds.
Renewing our minds.
Yeah, aligning our thoughts and our actions with God's will.
Okay.
And resisting those temptations that pull us away from him.
So it's not just a passive thing.
No, not at all.
It takes effort.
It does.
Yeah.
It's about actively choosing to follow Christ.
Right.
To put on that armor of God we talked about.
Yeah, yeah.
And to stand firm against the schemes of the devil.
It's about making choices
mm-hmm.
that reflect our commitment to God.
Right.
Even when it's hard.
Even when it's hard.
It's a constant battle, isn't it?
It is.
We have to be on guard all the time.
Mm-hmm. You know, ready to fight off those negative thoughts, those temptations that creep
Why?
In.
But the good news is we don't have to fight alone.
Yeah, that's true. We have the Holy Spirit.
We do.
Living inside us, empowering us, guiding us. Strengthening us.
Right. It's like having a divine coach in our corner, you know?
Yeah.
Helping us to train, to strategize, to stay motivated.
To stay in the fight.
Exactly.
Yeah. And we also have each other, right? We have the support of other believers.
That's right. Our brothers and sisters in Christ
mm-hmm.
who are fighting alongside us. We're not meant to do this alone.
No. And that's so important to have a community, you know, people who get it,
mm-hmm.
who understand the struggles,
right.
who can encourage you, pray for you, celebrate with you.
Exactly. We can learn from each other.
Yeah.
Share our burdens, hold each other accountable.
Right.
Spur each other on.
It's like a spiritual support group.
You know, a band of warriors all fighting for the same cause.
That's a great way to put it. And ultimately, the goal of this spiritual warfare,
yeah.
it's not about becoming, you know, expert fighters.
Right.
Or defeating as many enemies as possible.
Okay. So what is it about?
It's about growing in our relationship with Christ.
Mm.
Becoming more like him. Reflecting his love and grace to the world around us.
So it's about transformation. both within ourselves and in the world.
Exactly. It's about letting God's love and power work through us to bring healing, hope, and reconciliation to a broken world.
Wow. Well, this deep dive into God as a warrior has been it's been amazing. It's really opened my eyes to a lot of things.
You too.
We've covered so much ground, from the actual battles of ancient Israel to the spiritual warfare that we face today.
It's been quite a journey. And I think the biggest takeaway for me is that God is always waiting for us.
Over.
Even when we don't see it or feel it. He's the ultimate warrior.
He is.
And he's already won the victory for us.
Yeah, that's a powerful reminder
that
we're not alone in this battle.
No, you're not.
We have a God who loves us,
mm-hmm.
who fights for us, and who empowers us to live victoriously, even when things are tough.
Exactly. And as we surrender to his leadership,
yeah,
allow him to equip us and join him in this fight,
mm-hmm.
we can experience the fullness of his victory in our lives.
Right.
And be instruments of his peace and healing in the world.
That's a beautiful thought. Thanks for taking this deep dive with us.
It's been my pleasure.
Until next time, remember, you are not alone in this battle.
You're not.
God is with you, fighting for you, and empowering you to overcome.